Our speaker this morning is the award-winning author of the non-fiction book Losing Dad, Paranoid Schizophrenia, A Family's Search for Hope, which shows the devastating impact that severe mental illness can have on the entire family. She's an educator and mental health advocate, not only speaks about mental illness, but also drives change. She serves on the board of directors of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Orange County. She also serves on the Orange County Education Medical Advisory Council, where she strives to improve mental illness education and support in schools. She was awarded the I Make a Difference Award by the Garden Grove Education Association in recognition of her community involvement and mental health advocacy. In her ongoing quest to discover just how much can be accomplished with only 24 hours in a day, she also teaches high school English full-time and in her spare moments, when she's not spending time with her two sons, friends, and pets or writing. She is passionately advocating for those affected by mental illness. Here today to help us understand the mentally ill patient's family, an untapped resource, will you please join me in welcoming our speaker, Miss Amanda LaPera.
First of all, I want to thank your congregation, because as I learned more about you, you have done put such a tremendous amount of effort into helping the homeless in the community and supporting NAMI and mental illness. So I do want to thank you before I get started for all you've done. If you would imagine for a moment, imagine you are 53 years old. You have a master's degree. You've been working at a company for 17 years as a professional. You have a family, a spouse, three children. You have a house in the suburbs, great family, community. And then you're diagnosed with cancer, which is in itself traumatic. But you have a great support system. You have family, you have community, you have friends, and you go in for surgery. And when you come out, the prognosis is good. Everything went well. And then you notice everyone starts treating you differently. Suddenly your family and friends are trying to avoid you. They say you're strange. They say you're sick. They tell you to take medication. And you don't understand why everyone is turning on you. This is the experience my father went through. And his perception of everyone treating him differently was actually because my father came down with a severe mental illness after his release from the hospital. At the age of 53, my father developed paranoid schizophrenia. He started seeing things, hearing things, auditory, visual hallucinations, things that weren't there, and it became very difficult for our family to go through. Now, when I was younger, I had a great growing up with my father. He was a great dad. He used to take us on road trips. He'd stay late teaching me how to bet on blackjack and, you know, all the good quality time. And it was wonderful. He taught me a lot of things about life and cultures and appreciating different people and being open-minded. One thing he did, though, he very much valued education. And when we'd go in the street sometimes, walking, going here and there, sometimes we'd walk by homeless people. And you may have seen them on the street, and I'm not talking the people that are standing there at the corner asking for money. I'm talking the ones who are in the doorway, the ones who are underneath the clothes, the ones who may be talking to themselves, the ones that are avoided. And my father, and I don't think he's the only one, would tell me things like, if you stay in school, you'll be okay. That's what happens when you drop out of school. That's what happens when you try drugs, just say no. And so these are the kind of things that terrorize me as a child. I thought, okay, I better stay in school and say no to drugs. My father taught me, though, later on, that was not true about homeless people. And he taught me that when he became homeless. Now, how this came about is when my father became ill coming out of the hospital, and he started with these auditory and visual hallucinations, he wouldn't take medication. He didn't think he was ill. And what went on to happen is he did a lot of irrational things. He was let go of his job because of his behavior. He became paranoid, thinking people were out to get him, including his son, my brother, who was 15 at the time. Then he went on to take my stepmom from California to West Virginia, where he hallucinated and saw her as something she was not, the devil. And he had taken up reading the Bible, which he had already been religious and had a church, but he had been doing this all night, and it became an obsession. He ended up believing he was a prophet of God, and that God was directly speaking to him. Now, if you think that's possible, and, you know, maybe it is, I know it's not true with him because he told me a lot of dirty jokes. And I don't think a prophet would do that. But he took off then on the first flight out of the country and then traveled to over 30 countries, 4 continents, as a prophet of God. He spent his entire life savings. He cashed out about $250,000 from a 401k and traveled the world with that, giving money away as he went, and then returning back to America, homeless. See, during this time period, though, he disappeared. And we thought he was dead. We had no idea where he was. My stepmom was calling the State Department. It had many Americans been found overseas. It was a very difficult time. But at this time, I needed to go on with my life. I had to continue living my life. When my dad first became ill, I was in college. And what do you say when someone calls you and says, I'm hearing this is what the angels are telling me and stuff. And he's telling me things, and I say, I have an exam tomorrow, Dad. I hope this gets better and goes away. I'm sorry. I've never known anyone with mental illness. I didn't even know what it was. I thought maybe Dad's a little off, but he'll be fine tomorrow. So we kind of ignored the problem until it got to that point. Well, I went on with my life. I had a son. I became a teacher. And as I was teaching, a couple of years later, you have a few moments here or there before the bell, and you don't want them to get wild, which they do sometimes. It's a classroom management thing, and bond with them. And I would share a few stories with my father. They would become very quiet, and I'd say, oh my gosh, that's incredible. You need to write that into a book. You need to share that information with other people. And I said, oh, come on. I was living it every day. It didn't seem any different to me until I stopped, pulled out, and said, oh, wait a minute, this is unusual. And so it was my students that actually pushed me to write a book. Because it was over a year of hearing this from different classes, different students kept saying this. I said, you know, maybe I will. I'd forgotten I used to write when I was younger, but it was something I'd forgotten with life. And so I set out to write a book, and this is the book that I wrote. This is called Losing Dad, Paranoid Schizophrenia, A Family Search for Hope. And this was a very difficult book to write because I interviewed over 12 people, everybody who was currently alive in my father's family. I wanted a complete picture of what happened, how it happened. I was searching for answers. And so this was told from the perspective largely of his wife, my stepmother, as well as his children. My father was an only child, but his parents as well. And it was hard to see what happened when my grandparents passed. On their deathbed, my father cursed them out. And I love my grandparents. That was very, very difficult for me to hear. And it was hard as the grandchildren to stand at my grandparents' funeral in my father's place, knowing that this was what he should be doing. At any rate, when I wrote this book, which took me a while and a lot of research because I wanted it to be very accurate and yet interesting too, I started getting angry. I thought, why? Why did my father, he is not just someone who's doing drugs or drinking. My father never did that. He was intelligent, educated, wonderful, very caring person. Why did this have to happen to him? And when I became angry, I started learning about some things. I don't know if anyone has heard of the term anosognosia. Because I sure hadn't. It took me a long time to pronounce it. You know, on the online, you could let them say it over and over again on the dictionary. So I'd repeat it. Anosognosia. And this is different from denial. See, we thought my father was denying that he was sick. And so we would constantly try and tell him, you're ill. He'd say, no, I'm not. You're ill. No, I'm not. Why are you being so stubborn? And then I learned that this is actually a biological condition in your brain, where a person is unable to see they are ill. Now, severe mental illness impacts a lot of people. Actually, about 1 in 17 people. This is both according to the World Health Organization as well as the National Institute of Health. One in 17 people is diagnosed with a severe mental illness. I'm not talking just depression, anxiety. I'm talking schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and some of the most serious disorders. It is estimated that up to 50% of those individuals suffer from anosognosia, which is why they won't take treatment. They won't accept treatment. Would you, if I came up to you and said, you have a disease, and you don't think you have it, would you take medication? How many of you would do that? May have side effects too. So that's logical. You say, no, why would I take medication for something I don't have? And that's what anosognosia is, and that's why so many of the severely mentally ill refuse treatment. And I know we hear about a lot of tragedies right now, Santa Barbara, Columbine, well, that one had other things going on as well, but we have the Virginia Tech shooter. We have all these things in the media where they start to think the mentally ill are dangerous. They are violent. But that's actually not true. The severely mentally ill are more likely to become a victim of violence than a perpetrator of violence. The people that are committing some of these acts of violence are those who have a severe mental illness that is not being treated. So therein lies the problem. How do you treat someone when they don't think they are sick? Well, this became a problem, and I didn't understand much about it. I was frustrated, but I didn't know what to do with my frustration, so I did like many people would do. I ignored the problem and kept on with my life. So, until in Fullerton, the Kelly Thomas incident happened. Now, when the Kelly Thomas incident happened, and I read about this in the newspaper and on the media, that hit me. That hit me really hard. Because that homeless man who had schizophrenia, his family knew he was sick. They tried to get him help, but he refused treatment, anosognosia. I know his father, Kelly Thomas's father, Ron Thomas, a wonderful man, and he had tried quite a bit to get his son help. And I thought, that could have been my father. And that hit me. And I said, you know what, I'm angry. And then I read in the newspaper people's stories about, why didn't the family do more? Why did they let their son be homeless? Well, what I didn't realize, those homeless people that you see, many of them, they have fathers, they have mothers, some sisters, brothers, sons, daughters, spouses even. They have family. But the family is often powerless to keep them off the streets. Well, I started seeing in the newspaper people blaming. I got angry and I started writing out, this is not true. You don't understand until you are in those people's shoes what they are going through. And a lot of the laws stand in the way of people helping their family. Well, I'd keep quiet, I'd see another newspaper story, I'd write a letter, and there's something about the universe and the way it goes and what God's intentions are, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to stop swimming upstream, and I'm going to turn around and go whatever direction I'm meant to go in. And that's how I got involved in advocacy. People then invited me in to join the board of directors of National Alliance of Mental Illness because I've been speaking out of the board about something called Laura's Law. How many of you have heard of Laura's Law? Our county did something historic. Yay, Orange County. And recently we approved Laura's Law and implemented that's assisted outpatient treatment. And all over the state they were watching because Orange County was the first large county to implement this on top of being a very conservative county. Right afterward, I suppose you may have heard, San Francisco approved it. Los Angeles County approved it. We've got some momentum going on that. So as I learned about these things, I thought, well, what can be different? What can I do? I want to do more. How can things be different if you have a family member suffering from this disease? Do you have to let them be homeless? What can you do differently? Now, there are things you can do. One main thing is communication. Our family did not communicate. Each of us dealt with it in our own way because there was stigma. I didn't want to go, hey, how's it going, my new friend? So, by the way, my dad hears voices. How are your parents doing? Want to come to dinner? So, and my stepmom, even in her church, a lot of the people became very uncomfortable. When my dad became ill, he would say irrational things. So rather than talking to my stepmom and saying, do you need help? What's going on? Are you getting help? They avoided them. Pleasantries. Hi, how are you? And then walk away. I don't want to deal. That makes me uncomfortable. So communication is something, if our family had communicated better, we could have coordinated his care in a better way. And there's something called the HIPAA law. And a lot of doctors hide behind the HIPAA law because they try not to share information with family members, which they need to be doing. Because when you go to a doctor, you say, you know, doctor, I'm not feeling well. I'm having this, my heart, I'm having pain here, my chest. What is wrong with me? So he runs tests. He determines maybe you have high blood pressure. He hands you some medication. You go on your way. Mental illness is not the same way. People still think they can go to a doctor and say, here, doctor, fix me. The problem with mental illness is you're not aware of what you're doing in a lot of ways. So if the family is not brought in to speak with the doctor and explain the symptoms that they see, then you're not going to be getting appropriate care. So when I met with the Orange County Psychiatric Association, they said, bring the family in at the beginning of the treatment plan. If they are in, then we can communicate with them. I also, as a teacher now, I start to see all sorts of students with their mental illnesses, and somehow they are drawn to me. I don't know. I'm okay with that. I tell them right initially, the first day of school, talk to them about mental illness and say, if you have questions, see me. And what is amazing on how this world is changing is when I did introductions on the second day of school one day, I had a freshman boy in my honors class stand up because they were doing introductions. And he said, I have schizophrenia. A lot of people think I'm strange, but it's how I am. The class clapped for him. So things are changing. And I was, wow, exactly, that's what I thought. So that's one thing we can do is communicate more. And a teacher cannot go to a parent and say, hey, I think your kid has a bipolar disorder. That would look good for me and my job. I am not a doctor. But if a parent knows their child has something, they should communicate with the teacher and say, can you watch and see if you see any behaviors different? Communicate with teachers. Because I had a student disappear for a week. When she came back, I said, where were you? She said, in a mental hospital with schizophrenia. She was 14 years old. I said, well, what did they do for your family when you got out? Nothing. And that's commonly the case. And I said, well, here's some information about NAMI. Let me go ahead and get you some help and tell you where your father can go get more information. Because that's how I got introduced to NAMI, too, is I took a family-to-family class. They had a lot of free classes. And I came out of there knowing more than I think my dad's psychologist did. And he ended up in 3 involuntary hospitalizations with 3 suicide attempts. So we have been through quite a bit in our family. At any rate, besides communication, also stigma. By people talking about it, I find when I come out and talk to people, beforehand I say, so, do you have any experience with mental illness? And some people say, yeah, I came to hear you speak. And I say, oh, well, let me tell you about my father, my family, my mother. And then they say, oh, you know, I have a brother. I have a sister. I have a daughter, a neighbor, a friend, a coworker. And so then when you speak about it, other people speak about it, it becomes okay. Because it's really a brain disease, no different than heart disease, and somebody wouldn't be any different to say, hey, you know, I've got a heart disease. It's the same as saying I have a brain disease, not to judge people that way. And one thing I know, too, is there is still hope. And that's one message I want to carry, too. There is still hope for families. And even my family, my father has been missing since 1999, is when he took off. I saw him briefly in 2004 when I was able to get him off the streets for a few months. I saw him briefly in 2006. In 2008, when I had an agent, she told me to tell my father about the book, and that was probably the worst mistake I ever made. He cut off communication with me. And so to this date, we have a missing persons out on him. We don't know where he is. He usually is somewhere between Chicago or Florida. And if anyone who says, let those people with mental illness have a right to have their mental illness and choose to avoid medication, I don't think that's fair, because a man who is homeless does not choose to be if he has a severe mental illness. Nobody can tell me when my father was hospitalized for frostbite, almost losing a foot, or when he had his nose broken by drug dealers because he was talking to the wrong group of people and was very insistent. Nobody can tell me that when that happens to a person, they choose that. And so I think they should have the option to have a better life. But the hope I want to share with you came just this week. One of my friends sent me an email and said, check out this story. So I did. And I don't know if you've heard this, but in Connecticut, a man, a homeless man, who had been missing for 6 years. He's 60 years old. He has schizophrenia. Was not taking his medication and disappeared from his family for 6 years. They thought he was dead. When a police officer in Connecticut did some extra checking out, and that police officer found out this man was a missing persons. And he got in contact, this just happened last week, and the family drove out, the sister, the brother, they picked him up, the niece, and they brought him into care. And he's reunited with his family. So there is hope, and I hold down to that hope that perhaps our story may end the same way. But even if it doesn't, I want to go out and share information to help other families and other people avoid the tragedy that happened to mine. So that's what I want to leave you with, is there is hope.
A little bit about Boris Lodge. Could you explain a little bit more about what Boris Lodge does? Because I don't know the details of it.
Sure. It is pretty complicated if you look at it. I remember I was just a few months ago at a conference, and some police officers were behind me learning about things. They're like, what is Laura's Law? So I took my book, opened it up, so here, read about it. But what it is assisted outpatient treatment. This is court-ordered, mandated treatment for a person as a condition of remaining in the community. This is not someone that affects someone that has a severe mental illness but is functioning. This is a very narrow criteria to qualify. It's somebody who has already been cycling in and out of the mental hospitals or in and out of the prison system. So when they are about to commit this person, or they see they are at a danger of getting there, is instead of putting them back into a mental hospital, let them stay in the community with their family who loves them and cares for them, but to be under court-mandated treatment. And this actually does work in Nevada County, where Laura Wilcox, the young college student who was shot to death by a man with schizophrenia untreated, which is where the law came from. Nevada County has found that for every dollar they spend, they save about $1.50, because this is a very small but very costly part of the population. And so that's it. Hopefully that explains a little bit more. And if you want more details, I do have a lot of information about it, too.
Hi. I want to honor you for sharing your family story. 18 years ago, I was diagnosed with a major depression, which is not as severe as you described. And I was lost, and so was my family. My children, who were absolutely terrified, didn't know what to do. I spent a year on state disability, and at that time I discovered 12-step program, which is called EA, Emotion Anonymous. Now, we don't go around and advertise on every corner as AA doesn't advertise. It's not something that people... But over the years, in the last 18 years that I've been a sometimes regular, sometimes irregular visitor, I have seen a change. And the more we talk about the truth in our lives, first of all, we open communication for other people to talk about it, and we share information how to assist each other, how to support each other. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you very much.
Thank you, and I'm glad that you're doing well. And a major depressive disorder is actually also considered part of the severe mental illness group. And just to mention real briefly, NAMI, besides offering the family-to-family classes, which is for families of adult members, doesn't have to be a child, of someone with a mental illness, you learn about the mental illness and how you can support them. They also have a peer-to-peer class that is taught by individuals with a severe mental illness to others who are going through this. So they had a lot of classes that are very helpful. Yes.
I appreciate your talk. I have witnessed quite a little bit of mental illness in my family, and one that I'd like your comment on in particular was a first cousin who had paranoid schizophrenia and who passed away because he froze to death as a homeless person.
Wow.
His story was he was a very talented artist, and when he took his medicines, he couldn't work. He couldn't do anything creative. And when he did, he just, you know, when he got off of the medicines, he was able to experience the joy of being creative. And I wonder, you know, if you've heard of other cases that are like this. There are trade-offs. Sometimes terrible trade-offs between people who, you know, people who have these problems, and, you know, what is their life like? I mean, the side effect in his case was to just reduce it to mere vegetablehood, really.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that that has happened for your family. Fortunately, medication has come a long way, and that was, unfortunately, too often. I heard that so many times before in some of the medications. Now they have a whole different class of psychotropic medicines with much fewer side effects and more effect. And I can see mental illness does run in families. And I have several other family members with severe mental illness who were not treated well under medication but are now taking more current medication, and it's amazing. They are still themselves. They are still able to be creative. They are still able to function, not falling asleep, things like that. So sometimes what's hard about it is they try different medications, but at least they have many, many more to choose from than the ones that did sometimes more harm than good in the past. So
I grew up with a severe bipolar mother, and she never would accept that she really had the problem, but I think she did know she had the problem, but the stigma of mental illness, she wouldn't admit it because she didn't want anybody to think she was crazy. But towards the end of her life, after my dad died, he left her well enough to survive and take care of, you know, have things taken care of her. Well, she got involved with a man who basically was a con artist and took almost everything. And I tried to contact the police, and they said because she was still functioning, we couldn't do anything about it.
That's horrible. I'm sorry you went through that. As a person with a mother who also has bipolar disorder, yes, my child who was great, she was, unlike my father, she had no relation there. She was not taking medication either, and I think related to the stigma. And so it was very interesting growing up for my brother and I. We learned things like how to pick locks to go talk to mom, you know, which is interesting, so, which is a valuable skill. But right now, the hope is with things like, and I don't know if your mother had been in and out of mental hospitals, because if she had, that's the kind of individual that would have been helped by Laura's Law. Because the problem is, after deinstitutionalization and after they closed a lot of the hospital beds and the LPS Act, Lanerman-Petras Short Act, it was reduced to somebody has to be immediately in danger of killing themselves or someone else to get help. And some of the criteria we're working to move back is danger. Danger to themselves could be, I can't take care of myself, I can't make appropriate decisions. And so that criteria needs to change. And in fact, if I can mention just a moment, there is a very important law that needs to be implemented that right now is going through Congress, and it's called H.R. 3717. And H.R. 3717 is helping families in mental illness. And it cuts a lot of the roadblocks for people who could not help their family members. So the hope is if we can get that passed, that families will have a much easier time helping family members like that. because, like I said, they are far more likely to become victimized like that, victimized either of violence or taken advantage of than they are to be perpetrating violence. Yeah.
First of all, I just want to say thank you so much for sharing your incredibly moving stories. I personally have had some minor experiences with individuals who have suffered from psychological breaks from reality. I was dating a girl about a year and a half ago. We were together for about a year and a half, actually, and she was diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder. And I just, how does one tell the people that they love that they need help? How does one tell a person who won't even tell her family, won't even admit to herself that she has a problem? How do you tell them that they need help when you are the only person that they will go to?
And that's a tough problem a lot of people go through. For me, when I went through the family-to-family program in NAMI, a lot of those individuals that were going through the program had a significant other or had whatnot who was not perhaps in treatment, and they learned more about it, learned how to approach them. They did a lot of kind of role play, how do you speak to them differently to try and make a difference. If I may recommend, there's a really good book out there called I Am Not Sick, I Don't Need Help. And if you have a mentally ill, that's a very familiar, that's a great title. I Am Not Sick, I Don't Need Help by Dr. Javier Amador, who's done a lot of research with anosognosia. And had I read that book before, I would have treated my father differently, because a lot of it is based on relationships and getting people to change things without convincing them they're ill. But going about it, it's a very counterintuitive way, but it's pretty effective. So I would recommend looking at that book.
I've got a brother whose wife, a little bit closer, I'm sorry, we used to say she was manic depressive, but I guess that's what bipolar now.
Yeah, it's a different name now, yes.
Yeah, I never saw her depressed. This is just manic occasionally. And she refused to take medication. And that's why people will just about to fall into that category where they don't recognize that they have a problem.
Right. Yeah. So he had said that it was a brother's wife. Is that what it was?
Or, wife.
Yeah, your brother's wife who went through having manic depressant, which is now called bipolar disorder, and who was not accepting treatment. And he had seen the manic, but not the depressive side, which sometimes you don't see the depressive side. Some of these people that commit suicide, nobody on the outside, these people may smile and say, I'm fine.
Yeah.
Absolutely, I'm fine. In fact, my dad could talk his way out of a psychologist. He once went they were going to try and commit him for a fourth time. My stepmom brought him in, and he was evaluated. They wouldn't let her in at the same time because of privacy. When they brought her in, they said, your husband's fine. He may be a little religious, but he's fine. Here's a card. Maybe you should see someone and get counseling. So, yeah, I think even some providers are not aware of these things, and they're good at hiding stuff. But if someone has anosognosia and you go about trying to get treatment in a different way, like I had mentioned earlier, that would be much more effective than convincing someone they're sick and they need medicine. More in a way that it's improving relationships when we're doing stuff, when we're taking medication, look, we're getting along better, or whatever, you're doing better on the job, without saying, hey, you're sick. Because that's hard for someone to hear when they don't think they are. And if I can, for just a moment, do any of you have cell phones? Can you enter in a number I'm going to give you? Because I'm going to give you a phone number right now, and I would encourage you to call this just to get information. It's the Orange County Warm Line, and this is a resource. NAMI runs this call center. It's a resource to get resources for the community, advice. Sometimes it's run by peers as well. Here's the phone number. It's at Erie Code 714-991-6412. I'll repeat that. It's 714-991-6412. I also, if you missed that, I'll be here afterward in your coffee area, and I have that information. I can give that to you as well as any data you need. But I'd recommend you call this just for information, because if you have a family member, a friend, and a tragedy, a crisis occurs, you're going to do what you've done in the past. And if you've never called this number, you probably won't call it then. But if you've called it before and you're in a crisis, maybe you'll say, oh, yeah, there was that number I called. It's in my phone. And you can call and get help. And if you called 10 times, you'd get 10 different lists of referrals, because they've got a database of hundreds and hundreds of organizations.